With apologies to Mark Twain, if you don't like the economic news now, just wait a couple of minutes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 2nd of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, I know I took a couple of days off, and things have happened economy-wise in the past week or so, but come back with me all the same. To last Monday, a week ago today, the chaos was, for a change, subdued. Markets were happy. A trade war seemed distant. And cynical me, I said this. The warranty period on that no trade war thing I started with, by the way, 12 hours from right now. I'm not saying it took a whole lot of insight to put a time limit on everything being economic sunshine and light, but you take your wins where you can get them, especially in an economic news environment such as this. Turns out I undershot that warranty. It expired at the opening bell today, pretty much. We got Marketplace's Sabri Benishore on the phone for a little bit of context here from New York. Hey, Sabri.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so what gives today? Because right from the get-go, people were not happy.
Yes. Well, we are in the tit-for-tat stage in our trade dispute with China, and we just recently had a tat after a period of calm. So China, over the weekend, started to retaliate against the U.S. for the tariffs we placed on Chinese and aluminum and steel, and it put out a list of 128 products, everything from pork to macadamia nuts, that it was going to impose its own tariffs on. Now, by the way, this is just in retaliation for the aluminum and steel tariffs. This, we haven't even gotten to what they're going to do about the $60 billion worth of penalties the Trump administration announced a week and a half ago. So we don't know how China will respond to that. That's one thing that's rattling markets. I would just point out real quick, though, that markets are vulnerable right now. They're kind of, they're more volatile and more vulnerable right now. They're worried about inflation. They're worried about the Fed. They're worried about stocks being overvalued generally. Yeah. So when the market's kind of vulnerable like that, it's more susceptible to bad news. And we have had some bad news. Bad news, especially for anyone involved in making 128 products we sell to China.
Right. No, I totally get that. And that's a good point about vulnerability. And I'll tell you what, the tariff news on China was especially troubling when you have re-geared your entire industry to focus on China, as has, say, the American hog farmer. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
U.S. hog farmers export more than $1 billion worth of pork to China every year. There are parts of the pig that Americans don't fancy that the Chinese love. Jim Monroe is spokesman for the National Pork Producers Council.
So feet and tongue, stomach, or other parts of the pig like that, you know, where we don't see a lot of demand in the U.S.
25% tariffs on U.S. pork would hit key electoral states hard, like North Carolina, Iowa, and Illinois. Agricultural products actually top the list of America's exports to China. Kristen Duncanson grows corn, soy, and hogs in southern Minnesota, but her trade is global.
And we've worked hard over the last 20, 25 years, in particular in China, as we've seen that as an opportunity for our commodities.
A trade war would be bad timing for U.S. farmers, who are already reeling from low commodity prices. In this dispute, pork, cherries, almonds, and wine are in the crosshairs. But the big unknown is whether China will block U.S. soybeans. That's $14 billion in exports yearly. FYI, Washington is expected to fire next, arguing the Chinese are stealing U.S. intellectual property. Iowa State economist Wen Dongzhang expects new measures by Friday.
If we see that, then expect another round of escalation from the Chinese government.
He says in the past, when China closed itself off to U.S. farm products like poultry, it took farmers a decade or more to get back in. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Yeah, as Sabri was saying, tit for tat, and we're in the tat phase. Lest you think it was all international affairs that was spooking Wall Street today and raising some economic eyebrows, let me introduce you to a little company called Amazon. We've still got, I think, Sabri on the phone from New York. Sabri, explain to us what's going on here with Amazon and the Postal Service and the president and that whole story.
Oh, the president is basically fixated on Amazon, and he has for many weeks now been attacking Amazon. He's been saying that Amazon doesn't pay sales tax, that the post office is getting ripped off by Amazon, that Amazon hurts small businesses. He's been saying this for a while now. The difference is that today he also tweeted, "This will be changed." So you have to wonder, and I think markets are also wondering, well, is that colorful language? Or is there some plan in store to come down on Amazon? Because any hammer that comes down on Amazon could also come down on a lot of other tech companies. And by the way, we have also had a bunch of bad news for other tech companies. Intel's down because Apple's going to use its own chips. It's going to use its own chips in its phone, so it's ditching Intel. We, of course, had the Facebook Cambridge Analytica news from a couple weeks ago. Sort of the whole tech cluster is not exactly thrilled right now.
And we should point out here, by the way, thank you, Sabri, we should point out here that the president is incorrect in a lot of his statements about Amazon and the Postal Service, and specifically saying that Amazon is ripping off the Postal Service and costing them money. And it turns out Postal Service went into this arrangement with the world's biggest retailer, or one of them anyway, with its eyes wide open. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that story.
Mark Chardy, who's 51, has been delivering mail in New Jersey since his 20s. Back then, he says it was almost all first-class mail, bills, wedding invites. Now, the packages hurt his back.
You know, like 50, 70-pound bags. Some of them you can't even lift.
Many of them branded with that very familiar logo. Orders of dog food, water bottles, diapers.
Some people, that's all they do is Amazon. That's all they do.
All that online ordering, it's helping the Postal Service see double-digit increases in revenue. Over the last 11 years, the Postal Service has lost billions thanks to a decline in paper mail and costs for employee benefits and pensions, says Satish Jindal of the consultancy firm ShipMatrix.
If it wasn't for Amazon giving it all the volume it does, post office losses would be even greater.
For that reason, Jindal says Trump is wrong. Package delivery from Amazon is a bright spot for the service. But Kevin Kosar of R Street Institute says it's not that simple.
We just don't know what they're paying, and we certainly don't know if it ultimately plays out to be profitable for the Postal Service or not.
Kosar says Trump has no evidence that Amazon is scamming the system. He says when the Postal Service works with a company,
it doesn't just cut a deal in the back of some smoke-filled room. Instead, it's a huge amount of paperwork. Then that paperwork gets examined by the Postal Regulatory Commission to make sure that it comports with law.
Kosar says that paperwork is not even subject to the public via the Freedom of Information Act. And he says because of that, we really don't know if Amazon or any other retailer is getting a sweetheart deal on shipping. I'm Rima Kreis from Marketplace.
So to sum it all up, you take a looming trade war, you roll in the president of the United States taking aim at one of the economy's biggest companies. Tell you what, traders hate that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The last couple of years have been nothing less than very bad for Uber. There was the Delete Uber campaign after the first Trump travel ban. There were accusations of sexual harassment and a toxic workplace culture. There was the belated acknowledgement of a data breach and a payoff to the hackers in question to try to hide it. There was a lawsuit over the technology behind the company's self-driving cars and then the fatal accident in Arizona a couple of weeks ago. Into all of that stepped Dara Khosrowshahi last August, taking over for founder and, to be honest, source of a whole lot of the company's problems, Travis Kalanick. Sheila Kolhatkar, a staff writer for The New Yorker and, to boot, one of our Friday regulars, has a long piece on the company and its new boss in the latest issue of the magazine. Sheila, it's good to have you on.
It's great to be here.
Remind us all, would you, why Dara Khosrowshahi got this job at Uber, how that came to pass?
Well, Uber was and still is one of Silicon Valley's most successful companies, and it grew extremely rapidly in less than 8 years from a startup into a company that was valued around $70 billion. However, at the same time that it achieved this incredible growth, it also became one of the most scandal-plagued companies, I would say, in American business history. And ultimately, Uber's founder, Travis Kalanick, was pushed out last summer by a handful of investors, and Dara was brought in to clean up the mess.
Am I oversimplifying too much to say that, you know, in addition to his good strategic ideas, he seems like a good guy, too?
My sense of him is, yes, what you see is what you get. He seems like a nice person, high integrity. He's a very powerful communicator. A number of people commented on this to me. it's hard not to compare him to Travis, the person who built Uber into what it is, because I don't think he thought much about that at all. He was too busy trying to achieve world domination for the company. And he would often end up sort of offending people. That started to really hurt the company's reputation and damage its business.
So what is Dara Khosrowshahi then trying to change, right? Because Uber still has big, ambitious goals, but it's not complete and total world domination, right?
Well, so there's a handful of investors, sort of powerful investors, who got into Uber early, and they've seen a very large unrealized gain on their investment. So they've seen their paper value of their holding in the company go up and up and up, but they can't really monetize that because the company is not public. So Dara's number one job, in addition to trying to resolve the reputational issues of the company, is to prepare it to go public. And you can already see in some of the decisions he's made, you know, he's starting to worry a little bit more about losing money and spending money on kind of what he calls moonshot projects that might not work out. He wants to be a little more disciplined and focus on parts of the business where they can be more certain of achieving success.
Yeah, the biggest one of those areas he's concerned about, as you say in this piece, especially given what happened in Tempe, Arizona, with the woman who was killed by the autonomous vehicle, is the self-driving program at Uber, right?
Yes. And if you really look at Uber's business, it's hard to really see how this business model works over the long, long term without some driverless car aspect. And there was this terrible accident. And so now the program is on hold. And Dara told me that he's just reevaluating everything about it. You know, they really have to look at the question of whether the risk is going to be worth it.
Since you mentioned Silicon Valley culture, there's also the founder's culture in Silicon Valley, right? And the longer a founder is in power at a company, the tougher it is to change the culture of that company. And Travis Kalanick was at Uber since the beginning and just left like 6-8 months ago, right? How big is Dara's challenge in writing the culture of the company as he tries to get all this other stuff done?
Well, investors in Silicon Valley said to me over and over, founders create the culture. And just because you remove a founder from a company does not mean the culture is automatically going to change. It is woven in throughout every aspect of that company. And that's going to be a struggle for him. And he can set a good example. But there are a lot of people still at Uber who came there because of Travis. They were hired by him, groomed by him, believed in his mission. So Dara is going to have to sort of bring all of those people along.
Sheila Kahl-Hutkar is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, writing most recently The Letter from Silicon Valley about Dara Khosrowshahi and Uber. Sheila, thanks a lot for your time. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Kai.
Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. So before we do today's numbers, here is another number to think about. $5 a month. $5 a month, and you can become a Marketplace investor. The payoff? Knowing that you're helping thousands of people understand this economy, having conversations that matter, and making better financial decisions. Donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up.
If the management wants to commit fraud, the auditors are unlikely to find it.
Well, that's great. Chinese companies on American markets. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so here's the deal. We get the Wawa's with the Dow off 458 points, 23,644, 1.9%. The Dow at the low today off 750+. So it could have been worse, I suppose. I don't think we have really sad Wawa trombones, do we? The Dow off, rather, I gave you the Dow. The NASDAQ down 2.7%, 193 points, 6870. S&P 500 erased 2.2%, 58 points, 25.81. Tariffs and tech delivered the 1-2 punch, as Sabri was telling us. J.P. Morgan Chase slid nearly 2%. Goldman Sachs down 1.7%. Tech stocks don't even with that. Facebook off 2.7%. I should say another 2.7%. Netflix unspooled 5%. Intel down 6%. Sabri told you about that. Apple is going to stop using its chips. Bond prices, get a load of this. I'll repeat myself if I have to. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Me Too has brought to light sexual harassment and assault problems in Hollywood. In public radio, to be sure, and commercial media as well. Also in the restaurant industry. Celebrity chefs and restaurant empires have been brought low, but despite all the high-profile cases, change is slow to come farther down the food chain. In fact, people inside the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission call restaurants and the food service field in general a problem industry when it comes to sexual harassment. Laura Benchoff has more now from Philadelphia.
It's an hour before customers will start arriving at Philly Tacos, a small storefront restaurant in South Philly. Juliana Cerrito with Women Organized Against Rape has turned the dining room into a temporary classroom, projecting PowerPoint slides onto the shiny teal walls.
I'm so sorry that I'm not going to translate the entire training because it will take 2 hours.
Switching between English and Spanish, she explains what sexual harassment is to a small gathering of restaurant workers, owners, and advocates sitting around the dining room tables. She says the law is pretty clear about what kinds of sexual behavior at work are illegal. The first is quid pro quo sexual harassment.
Quid pro quo, que significa dame esto por aquello.
That's when someone demands sexual favors or attention in exchange for a benefit, like a better shift or just to keep a job. The other is creating a hostile work environment. This is the first training by the Coalition for Restaurant Safety and Health. The newly formed group, which is made up of attorneys and advocates, wants to show restaurant workers how to respond to sexual harassment and encourage bosses to adopt anti-harassment policies. Nadia Hevka is an attorney and one of the founders of the coalition.
The way the law works on sexual harassment is that an employer has to be aware of a situation before it's legally liable for not curing it. So it's up to people to come forward and put an employer on notice. The employer then has to do something.
She says the timing of this initiative, coming on the heels of the Me Too movement, was purely coincidental because it's not a new problem. A 2012 survey of Philadelphia food service workers by the Restaurant Opportunity Center found more than a third had experienced sexual harassment in the previous year. Similar training groups have sprung up in New Orleans and California to try to teach workers and owners to address this pervasive problem. Mary Garten has been a server for about 6 years, first in Vermont, now in Philadelphia. We met up at a coffee shop near her job. Last year, she had a particularly bad experience at an Irish tavern in the suburbs where she was working. She asked the assistant manager for help with a customer.
I went over to him and I was like, hey, that regular just grabbed my ass. And it made me really uncomfortable. I was like, I don't really want to serve him. I don't, like, will you intervene?
Then she says her boss made things worse.
And instead, what he did was grab my ass and say, oh, like that? And so I quit.
Garten says turnover related to sexual harassment can feel like par for the course, but she knows things can get better. She says when she lived in Vermont, more restaurants she worked for had sexual harassment policies and would enforce them. Between losing employees and maybe getting sued, restaurant owners have financial grounds to try to prevent harassment. Juan Carlos Romero owns Philly Tacos. He gives another reason in Spanish why he plans to post a new policy about sexual harassment in his restaurant. He says he wants his restaurant to be a nice place to work and eat, and not just for him. In Philadelphia, I'm Laura Benchoff for Marketplace.
Scott Tong was telling us earlier about the current state of the tariff to and fro with the Chinese. Fraught, I believe, is the current indicator, or to quote Sabri Benishore, we're in the tat phase. But the economic relationship we have with China is more than just trade, right? It's capital, too, investments. And that's where things can get tricky when you have two economic systems that don't necessarily play by the same rules. The rules, specifically in this case, being the ones that govern publicly traded companies. Documentary filmmaker Jed Rothstein looked into the hundreds of Chinese companies, companies not always on the up and up, it's important to know, that in the years around the financial crisis came to be listed on American stock markets. It's his new film. It's called The China Hustle. Jed, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
Get me from the financial crisis to the point in 2013-ish, right, when people start becoming aware of these reverse mergers?
Actually, it's a little different than that. What happened first and where our story starts is in the wake of the financial crisis, a lot of professional investors were looking for a way to make back all the money they had lost. And they turned to China because China was booming. They saw a lot of opportunity investing in these Chinese companies that were listed on U.S. exchanges. A number of them were reverse mergers. Some of them were not reverse mergers. But the main point is it was a way for these investors to make back their money.
Reverse merger. That seems to be the key to this entire thing. So I need you to explain this for me.
Well, a reverse merger in and of itself is not an evil thing.
Right.
And people will point out that there are plenty of brand name companies that anyone might have heard of that are reverse mergers. But what a reverse merger did at the time was allowed a Chinese company to merge with the shell of a defunct but still legally extant company here in the U.S. and take over their listing. And it was a way to get more quickly into the U.S. markets and with less scrutiny than a standard IPO.
When these reverse mergers happen, investors and some of the banks involved who front them in the United States say, look, they're audited financial statements and everything's groovy. And how can this possibly be a bad thing?
As Jim Chanos, who's one of the people in the film, says, whenever there's a big scandal, people ask him, well, who are the auditors? And he says, well, who cares? It doesn't matter. If the management wants to commit fraud, the auditors are unlikely to find it. And I think what we found in the story in the China Hustle is that a lot of the assertions made by some of the management of some of these Chinese companies were false. And the auditors at first certainly didn't know even how to track them down. I heard stories about people going into bank branches and demanding a statement. So as a way to check whether or not the amount of money the company says is in the bank on a given day is in the bank. And they would get a statement that verified that there was that much money in the bank. But only later did they find out that the bank manager was in cahoots with the management to print false statements. So they had to really dig several layers deep in order to uncover some of these things. And the auditors at first just weren't doing it.
Yeah. Just to recap, what we have are, in many cases, completely and knowingly fraudulent Chinese companies that become listed on American exchanges. You can go to the New York Stock Exchange or the Amex.
NASDAQ.
And the NASDAQ and find these companies and buy their shares. They are U.S.-listed Chinese companies.
That's right.
And what you have discovered, and the story you tell in this film, actually, is that a bunch of investors, and I'm not talking dozens and dozens, but a handful, relatively speaking, discover this and in the absence of regulation, go after these companies by trying to short them. That is, bet the stock will go down and short them out of existence.
The bulk of the problem companies were really found out by these short sellers. Some people argue in the film that that's the way it ought to be, that we ought to, you know, our markets are free and open and vibrant because we don't try to police these types of things before they're known about. I would argue that we could do better. You're never going to root out all fraud, but you can set up the rules of the game to really discourage it and hold people accountable and I think thereby diminish the amount of it.
Who gets hurt if there's, you know, dozens, a couple of hundred, you know, fraudulent U.S.-listed Chinese companies?
Well, we all do. The vast majority of losses were in this big skim from you and me and probably everyone in this studio and everyone who has a retirement account in amounts that maybe would be hard to pick out if you weren't paying very close attention. And then, of course, there are some people whose stories we tell in the film who invested directly in some of these companies and really got hurt in a more substantial way. And in fact, now the various indexes that are used to calibrate mutual funds and institutional investments include China in a more substantial way than they did at the time of this fraud. So it's even more, we're becoming more integrated. Mm-hmm. And I think that puts an onus on us all to demand better regulations that keep pace with the integration that we're seeing.
This film is landing and getting a lot of press at an interesting time for the U.S.-Chinese economic relationship.
Definitely. The impending trade war is, or Who knows
at this point? Yeah.
I turn to you, Kai. I listen to you every day to tell me whether or not we're going to be in a trade war. But the potential trade war, the dispute is not over the central issues that we talk about in the China Hustle. But it does go to a sort of deeper problem, which is the lack of communication between our governments about finance and between our regulatory agencies.
Jed Rothstein, the film is called The China Hustle. Jed, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Final note on the way out today, a follow-up of sorts to our story last week about Tesla's troubles. We told you how the company's most recent bond issue is having problems. Would-be buyers are demanding higher yield, that is a better interest rate, as Tesla consistently misses deadlines for its make or break Model 3. Well, according to an email from CEO Elon Musk that is making the rounds, in the first quarter of 2018, that is to say the quarter that ended Friday, the company, wait for it, missed another deadline for the Model 3, made only 2,000 of them, not the 2,500 of them promised. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials dropped 1.9% today, 458 points. But remember, that's actually good news. The Dow was down 753 at the low. NASDAQ off 2.7%, 193 points. S&P 500 erased itself 2.2%, 58 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.